Welcome to Recapturing Hollywood. I'm Tim Collins, editor in animated series and documentary.
I'm Michael Kinberg. I'm a feature screenwriter.
And we're here at Coffee Fix, the best coffee shop in Studio City, with Mitch Danton.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
We would love to rediscover some of Hollywood's past with you. You yourself have been an editor, an ACE, for a little bit, and also you grew up here.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I was born in Burbank at St. Joe's Providence Hospital there, and I grew up in the Hollywood Hills and also spent some time in the Sherman Oaks area and was in Los Feliz as well, and now I currently live in the Van Nuys Sherman Oaks area.
Your parents, your mother, tell us a little bit about her.
Julie Adams, born Betty Mae Adams. Her name was changed to Julia Adams at Universal Studios International in the early 50s when she went under contract there and made about 20 movies in 6.5 years there in the 50s. And remarkable actress, remarkable woman, just a legendary career between film, television, the stage, and also just a wonderful person that many people look up to this day, even though she's passed away 6 years ago. I miss her every day.
Right before the show, we had talked about you had recognized her name when I first brought Mitch in.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's because her famous film, one of her more famous, let us say, is The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which most people know. And she was luminous and striking. And the film itself is, you could, if you use the term cult, that may be a... perhaps an unfair thing, because it's just a very good film, and it can be said to be a cult, but it's also just a solidly well-written, well-directed, and certainly well-acted piece of work.
Yes, the filmmaking, especially the underwater photography, holds up to this day. First underwater 3D film ever made, so you can imagine how it captured the imaginations of audiences back in the 50s. First film with the second unit. My mother was filming out here at Universal Studios, and they were filming the second unit in Wakulla Springs in Florida. So there was an underwater creature, Riku Browning, who became a legend as well, and Ben Chapman, who was the creature on land.
Right.
And Ginger Stanley doubled my mother in Florida for the underwater scenes.
Was that a Jack Arnold production?
Yes, okay. It was directed by Jack Arnold.
Did she like working with him?
She called him a magnificent director. She loved him, yes.
That's great.
So he was quite a talent and did many other 50s sci-fi films.
Yeah. And television, too. Yeah.
Yes, he was it's an incredible film. I've seen it probably close to 100 times or more with audiences all over the country.
Yeah.
And it is probably adored more today than it was 70 plus years ago in the 50s, which is astonishing.
One of the few films in the 50s which you could say honestly had a sensual sense to it. It isn't just a guy in a wetsuit. There's a sensuality to it, which I think is unique, certainly in the 50s.
And appreciated.
With the exception of Marilyn Monroe. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, that white bathing suit is considered one of the most iconic bathing suits ever. It's up there with Marilyn Monroe's white blouse from The Seven-Year Itch.
Absolutely.
Which, coincidentally, they were coming out of Creature from the Black Lagoon in that famous shot in the movie when she comes out with Tom Yule, I believe.
Oh, okay.
And,
but it's also the way in which the underwater scene, when the creature is mimicking, if I can recall correctly, her moves as she's swimming and the sensuality of that.
She called that the underwater ballet, which was her favorite
Absolutely.
Scene in the movie.
Absolutely.
And she would watch dailies when they would come in from Florida, so she would see how it was intercutting and coming together, and was just was breathtaking for her to be a part of it. And I don't think, certainly herself, had no idea the film would become what it is. I guess who could know when you're filming something in like 6 weeks on two different coasts? And and it just turns out the suit designed by Millicent Patrick is one of the most iconic monsters ever created.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people involved with that. Jack Keevan, Bud Westmore, the whole team at Universal were involved with her costumes. But Millicent Patrick's become known as the Lady from the Black Lagoon. So it certainly was they sort of were trying to get a new movie made that was as popular as the earlier monster movies like The Mummy and The Werewolf and Frankenstein. And this accomplished that goal and was very profitable. I think they made it for several hundred thousand dollars, and it made $2 or $3 million, which was a lot of money back in those days. And it's been re-released multiple times. It's been shown on television.
And there are also sequels, as I recall.
Yes, there's Revenge of the Creature and The Creature Walks Among Us.
Right, I've seen those.
And now there is a new one in the works with James Wan potentially helming it, as I've heard or read. So there could be a very large budget version of The Creature coming our way soon, as well as The Shape of Water, which was largely inspired by the
Creature
from the Black Lagoon. I had the good fortune of meeting Guillermo del Toro, and he was very inspired by the iconic monster and my mother's role in the film, and was very gracious about how he was inspired by that film and wanted to make a version where the monster lives at the end. And it took him a good portion of his life to become famous enough to raise the money and do it. Yeah. And he got an Oscar to boot.
Yeah, that's so great.
So he's a very nice gentleman, and I'm very honored that he's part of the Creature legacy as well.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, did you ever get to visit your mother when she was on set? Or your father, for that matter?
In later years, I did, yes. But that was long before I was born, Creature from the Black Lagoon. But I did visit her on set quite often for the Jimmy Stewart Show, which was shot in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And
Was that Hawkins? Was that, which one was that? The lawyer show, you're saying?
Or? No, it was a kind of a family drama. It came out around the time of All in the Family,
which sort of
eclipsed everything in its wake in terms of a new family drama with Meathead and all that stuff.
Carol
O'Connor.
Yeah.
So they were kind of the last of the generation of sort of the Andy Griffith Show style of family drama that was more wholesome. And then it sort of, the family dramas became more edgy after that, that period.
Yeah.
And but she did have the good fortune to work on the Andy Griffith Show as well as Mary Simpson, the county nurse, which is a wonderful episode if anyone wants to revisit it.
Sure. Wow.
Did your father act in television as well, or what was he doing?
He did. He played many roles in television. Hawaii Five-0 was a big one that he did a number of those. Yeah. Maverick with James Garner and a lot of the old westerns that he worked on over the years. He was most famous for kind of the gangster movies. He was doing all the Bobby De Niro shtick before The Godfather became what it was, you know.
Right.
And if you ever watch The Rise and Fall of Legs Diamond, it's a wonderful role. He plays the lead, Lex Diamond. It's directed by Bud Bedeker, who was a famous director.
He did the Ronan
films, westerns. My mom also worked on a film with him called The Man from the Alamo and Wings of the Hawk. So Bud Bedeker looms large in our family history as well. And he's very well regarded these days.
As well he should
in
be.
In part because of his work with,
Stewart.
Randolph Scott as well.
And James Stewart,
they were filming up in Lone Pine in that area.
Yeah.
And those films have become classics. Ride Lonesome is one
of
them.
Ride Lonesome?
Yes.
Did he do Buchanan Rides Alone?
I'm not sure of that one. But he was a former bullfighter that became a director. And there was sort of this generation of gentlemen that came after World War II and were trying to find out what to do with their lives. And they were war heroes. But what do you do with being a war hero once you try and go to civilian life?
It was like
life?
William Wellman after the first war.
And Jimmy Stewart was a war hero, too, who got into acting and actually returned, I believe, in Vietnam briefly and served in that war in Korea. Mm-hmm. So he was a vet through and through and flew many missions. So my mother just adored Jimmy Stewart. Met him on Bend of the River.
That's a great
back
film.
In 1952.
Is that an Anthony Mann, or is that?
Yes, that's correct. Anthony Mann was the director on that, and it's sort of the Oregon Trail, she met Rock Hudson on that as well, they ended up doing three movies together, which was One Desire, and then The Lawless Breed as well. And
The Lawless Breed.
She loved working with Rock Hudson. Was just one of the few co-stars that was about her age, and they were just pals on the Universal back lot, and they were really like best friends.
Mm.
The experience on the back lot and things like that, how did your parents careers, not that you could have lived a different life, but how did your parents' careers influence your eventual choice to get into cinema and being an editor?
Yeah, what's most interesting about that was my parents got divorced in the 70s, right around the time my dad made the transition from acting to directing. So in those days, everyone cut on film, which was a very time-consuming, laborious process for anyone who's, you know, watched any documentaries about filmmaking would know that. And so I would spend weekends with my father. Many of those weekends were spent in the editing rooms on films and TV shows he worked on. One notable one was a film called Psychic Killer, which was an early horror film that he directed that's similar to Carrie, about telekinesis. It was originally called The Curlian Force, which is more mysterious, but they went with the more commercial Psychic Killer title, which was not my father, I think, preferred the original title because it sounded more artistic and creative. He's also the narrator of it, and he had this great baritone voice that tells what, you know, the Curlian Force is and how it affects people. And Jim Hutton, who some may know as Timothy Hutton's father, plays someone who's in an insane asylum and he escapes. And then he wreaks havoc on those who tormented him while he was behind bars. Yeah. And I had the good fortune of going in one day with Michael Brown, who's a famous editor who edited that movie. And they were working on a shower scene similar to the one in Psycho, except this one, the shower becomes scalding hot and burns this bad nurse to death who had tormented him. So I went in the room that day, and Michael and my dad were working on it. I never really thought of films in pieces. You know, you don't really, until you actually realize that a film is a series of little pieces that are put together to tell the story.
Yeah.
You don't really, you're just sort of taken in by, did you like the movie, didn't you like the movie? And I'd watched a lot of Saturday matinees of things that my parents had been in. But then I saw Michael putting it together piece by piece for an afternoon, and I was mesmerized by it. And from that moment forward, I wanted to be a film editor. And so that really was a catalytic moment where I decided this is what I want to do. And I spent lots of time on other shows that my dad was editing, which ultimately led to Cagney and Lacey later, about 5-6 years later, or maybe even a decade, where I was out of high school looking for things to do. And one of the editors, Jeffrey Rowland, who was working on the first season, was kind enough to let me spend time in the editing room with him. And I was hanging trims for him and just sort of, you know, doing what I could. It was so laborious back then that even any little thing you could do, whether it be getting somebody coffee or doing whatever you could to help them stay organized, they always could use an extra pair of hands and were kind enough to just let the director's kid kind of like be entertained and learn along the way. And you got to see what pieces they chose and why they chose them. And it was a very educational process. And it was kind of astonishing when I look back on it, because Jeffrey and I and a team of editors ended up editing The Path to 9/11 about a quarter century later. Mm-hmm. And we won an Ace Eddie Award and a Emmy Award for that. So it's interesting. Yeah, David Hammond, Brian Horn, Eric Sears were also on that with us. So it was kind of like this band that got together and made this kind of amazing miniseries that chronicled the events leading up to 9/11 based on the 9/11 Commission report. And it aired on the 5-year anniversary of 9/11 in 06. So it was kind of an amazing trajectory from going from hanging shrimps with somebody to being one of their collaborators on what at that time was the biggest show in the history of Touchstone Television with that budget. It was a 5-hour miniseries shot on multiple continents. So as my mom used to say, you never know how things will turn out in the movies.
That's right.
So to go from hanging trims to getting in the union to joining Ace, it's been a remarkable journey. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate enough to chronicle a lot of that in my book, Cutting It in Hollywood, and interviewed other editors as well who shared their journey. So the Motion Picture Editors Guild is a big part of my life, American Cinema Editors. So it all kind of started, you know, hanging trims for a friend of mine. And I, even prior to that, I had gotten a job at a place called Lejean Films on a movie called Penitentiary 2, which I don't know if anyone's ever heard of.
Leon Isaac Kennedy.
Yeah, there you go. Another movie called The Alchemist. Yeah. So I'm trying to, in some way, carry on my parents' tradition of horror between Creature from the Black Lagoon. My mother was also in a movie called Black Roses.
I haven't seen that,
And And then my father did Psychic Killer. I did another film called Death Master. So
was that Robert Quarry?
Yes.
I've seen that.
Yeah, Bob Quarry was a good family friend, a very brilliant man.
He was an Orson Welles actor.
I
saw Count Yorga and all that.
They would play bridge together. Bridge was a thing back then. And Rock Hudson would come over to play bridge.
Wow.
But Bob Quarry was extremely a bright man. And so they worked together on that Death Master film. But he was more than just a collaborator. He was a family friend.
And a nice man to boot.
Yeah.
He was a very fine actor. Right?
Yes, he was. He really was.
You don't work with the Mercury Theater if you're not on the ball, and he was. I didn't realize that until I looked him up.
I didn't know his history very well, other than that he, there was sort of a whole group of folks back in that time. Howard Rodman was another one who developed the $6 Million Man. He was one of the family friends as well. And Norma Rodman, who was an actress as well. That was his wife. So, yeah, Adam Rodman's also a writer who was their son. So, and then my stepfather, who was with my mother for many years in a long-term relationship, Ronald M. Cohen.
Yeah.
He had a Western tradition like Mom. He wrote a film called The Good Guys and the Bad Guys.
Was that Burt Kennedy?
Yes, Burt Kennedy.
Yeah, wonderful film.
Yeah,
wonderful
who was a writer early in his career and became a renowned director as well.
With Garner, as
yeah.
a matter of fact.
Yeah, so... And
Support
then
Your Local Sheriff. Great.
Yeah, Ronald
great.
Also wrote Twilight's Last Gleaming.
Yeah,
and,
with Burt Lancaster.
A very good political thriller.
Yeah.
And then near the end of his life, he wrote Last Stand at Saber River, starring Tom Selleck,
mm-hmm.
which was a TNT film that was very well reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fortunate enough to be around some... amazing people growing up, and certainly tried to learn what I could and glean from, you know, the many dinner parties they had with other folks that would, you know, show up along the way. One memorable dinner party was Alex Karras came over, and I remembered him well from Blazing Saddles, of course. Just a very nice man, and it just had a great career post his NFL stardom. So it was a nice story to see people that, you know, are able to reinvent themselves, which I think we all have to do in this business
from time to time. You have to hyphenate, I think.
Yeah, you go through the changes.
As your father did.
As my father did. He really, he did some acting in Europe when kind of Rome was that second Hollywood. And he had a big enough name in Hollywood that he could star in films overseas.
And
he did. He was so bright. He learned Italian, French, and Spanish in his 30s to act overseas in other languages. And so he was quite, and he was able to, you know, get his directing chops started over there. And then, as I mentioned, Death Master out here, and then Psychic Killer. And then he met Jack Klugman. They were friends from New York. And when Quincy took off, they became fast friends. And my dad directed, you know, dozens of episodes of that. And actually wrote a couple stories himself. One notable episode was called Main Man that my dad wrote the story for about a... It's very topical now. An athlete suffers... like a brain injury in the beginning, and they don't really know why or how. And then he has a younger brother who has a similar condition, and it's like between the sports father, played by Gene Roche, who's trying to save, he's so obsessed with his son getting a state high school record that he doesn't care about the health consequences. And Quincy's
awesome.
Like,
wow,
he's going to college, he could win a Heisman Trophy, there'll be dozens of records, you know, and he's just like, you know, who's been number two my whole life? It's me. My son's not going to be number two. And it's like, and it sort of epitomized every sports dad you've ever met at a Little League game. Or
every soccer mom.
My dad also, taught Pop Warner and coached it. And he was very familiar with that. So he was a leader of little men and big men, you know. So he loved coaching young people. Charles White was one of his famous players who won a Heisman Trophy at USC. So he had some notable... actors that he worked with as well as athletes when he was coaching Pop Warner.
So I'm curious, you had mentioned earlier in your career you had hung trims. So I'm by definition actually, because I always feel like you have that imposter syndrome, but I'm a professional editor and I've never hung trims, and I think I know what that is, but could you talk a little bit about what that is and then also how you've seen, let's say, feature editing change over your career?
Yeah, when I was very young, I was probably 10 or 11 when they were doing Psychic Killer, and when you went in there, every time you made a cut, the pieces that you didn't use were the trim. So you chose a piece, and then what was on the big before.
You're talking about 35 millimeter.
Yeah, so you imagine action and cut. So any piece you use, for purpose of an example, imagine there's an explosion, and there's one small piece, and then that explosion is the piece you use, and then everything between, you know, action and cut is the head and tail trim. And
those these are physical.
And you would hang them up according to code numbers. Each shot had numbers of, by foot. So you would have to hang them on the right trim, and if you did not hang them on the right trim, they would get lost. And when you went to look for them, you had a very bad day if you couldn't find them, because your whole day, they asked for a shot and you couldn't find it. It made for a long afternoon where you would have to slug something potentially.
Did you work on a Moviola or a Steinbeck?
That was mostly, I worked around a Moviola. Famous editors like Walter Murch were on, you know, Steinbecks, which is a chem.
They're also more gentle.
It's a different style. Michael Kahn, one of the more famous editors, so I had the good fortune of interviewing
him. Great, yeah.
And contributed to my book. He's always been a Moviola editor. Now he's editing electronically, which you were alluding to.
Yeah.
Well, now, basically, the computer, you never have to find a trim. The computer does all that for you. Wow. You know, it can help you with temp visual effects. Back in those days, say a dissolve would be like a grease pencil that went across film.
That's right.
And today, you would just push a button and you would be able to look at the dissolves.
Did you ever do, what was it called? After you finish the film, it's
negative cutting.
Negative cutting. Yes.
Yeah, negative cutting was a very precise occupation. So that was very exacting, because if you made a wrong cut, you could destroy a shot, or you'd have to, or if the negative broke, you'd have to find an alt take to replace it.
Because you're using, with a negative cut, the film that comes out of the camera. You're not using a print of that film.
Yeah, well, when we're editing, we're using what's called a work print.
Right.
And then you would match. Then basically they would cut the negative to match that, which would become an answer print, which in those days, you know, was an answer print. I believe it had an optical track that they would actually broadcast at the networks.
So
it was all done basically in analog. And same, all the mixing was done in analog. So
I'm
you can imagine
that's
20, 30 tracks of MAG running simultaneously. But with the editing itself, basically most of your editing was literally one picture track and one soundtrack.
Yeah.
So a sound effect was like a door knock or a, you know, a doorbell ring, or, you know, very few effects were put into the temp. Whereas now, as you can imagine, most temps are very elaborate to give the audience or the network or the studio an impression of what it's going to be. And now we often have music editors and sound editors working with us simultaneously. And in those days, it was usually on television anyway, it was part of a later process where you would spot sound and music, and then that would be created literally, you know, in a spotting session where these cues would happen. And now a lot of it is established with the editor and the director and the producers through the various cuts, deciding what songs go in and placing them, so that people, you know, the music is so integral to some of these shows now that you can almost, the show is almost, the visuals are almost a part, and the music is as big a part of the show as they were.
Yeah.
When I worked on Dawson's Creek, the songs were, and the whole WBCW vibe was, the music was such a big part of the audience's lives, that as was it with the characters on Dawson's Creek as well, you know, sort of recapturing that Boston local sound, you know, of where they grew up and things like that. It was set in North Carolina, but then when I was there, they were in college, and sort of the Boston scene was part of it as well. So,
In animation, the temp music and the temp sound effects are extremely important, and we're very used to adjusting them on the fly. You know, putting things in that'll be taken out later, because the animation animatic cut of an episode will have sound effects that kind of help tell the story where the storyboards leave off, where there's no motion yet because it hasn't been animated. I can imagine back in the day that must have been very different, doing some sort of a temp animatic in animation, where you have to take a whole, I mean, you probably have to go, I don't even know what it would be, like tape to tape. How do you cut sound effects analog?
Basically, you would cut it in just like a line of dialogue, you know, unless you were on a big show where you had multiple tracks that you were juggling. Then you would have to resync them as notes were done. So it was literally, but most of the effects we did were cut in just to, if it was something an actor reacted to, there was a siren and you were, a perp, then you knew the cops were coming, right? You know, so it was something that had to, signal the drama was changing. But now the music changes the tone of films so drastically that it's hard to imagine, understanding some of these shows without the music changes that they do. And they tend to evolve all the way through the final mix, but we try to give them at least as good an example between... we filter in what the music supervisors give us and the music editors, so that's A, things you can afford, B, things that the producers also like, and then we try them out and see how they work. And sometimes you get that magic moment where the song just drops in perfectly on another track, as you were saying, evolving another track on an Avid or Adobe Premiere or DaVinci Resolve or one of the systems that people work on today, where it's you're working on 24 tracks quite often, even on a television episode, just for temp. So it's a much more elaborate process, and then visual effects can go up multiple tracks as well. So
for me, the idea of even keeping track of the number of tracks is kind of silly, because I've only ever had it where I can right-click a track and say, add another track. To me, it's just another line where I can drop a sound effect. That's very interesting.
No, it is fascinating, because you have to sort of keep track of what's on all the layers of your... Avid, in the case of most of the shows I've worked on, and we do them different colors so we can see, what is your sound, what is your music, what is your dialogue. And it is, you really are orchestrating a scene, in the end, in terms of blending all those things together to make it all work. I edited Survivor for a while, and on the Survivor games, was blending sound ups with, say, the host, Jeff Probst, with the music, sort of signifying when you're getting different portions of the game. So the music kind of leads you along as well. Each music, there's a sort of a song that, or music piece that you would have for an intro. There'd be an action piece, maybe if it was an action game, and then the aftermath would have kind of the winners and losers. So the drama is very well told in the music as well as the editing on something like a Survivor game, and many action montages that I've done and so many other people do in television and film.
Cool. Well, I have a few more questions, but we're going to take a break, so we'll be back in just a moment. Back on Recapturing Hollywood with my co-host, Michael Kinberg, feature screenwriter, and our guest, Mitch Danton. You had mentioned that you worked on Survivor.
Yes.
How have you seen unscripted, meaning like reality TV, editing change since Survivor? Because that was one of the first shows.
To me, what's changed a lot was there was a lot more time on the original Survivor where people could really look at all the footage and analyze it. And I think that's one of the reasons the show was so well done. I mean, before 9/11, people literally thought they were spending an hour on the island. It was so well crafted. And then 9/11 happened, and people were like, oh, this is what real reality is. And then they actually moved the next season from Jordan to Africa based on that incident. So that event changed just about everything on the planet, from television to being able to get on a studio lot without a pass, everything, the whole, it felt like, when I was like a film runner years ago doing the film library, the lots were pretty available to people to get on. It wasn't, but after 9/11, security just, overtook just about every aspect of American society, including the studios. And then, so I would just say when the whole reality wave took off, the schedules just seemed to get tighter and tighter, which made it, because you could literally think up a reality show and have it on the air within a couple of months, and that's how,
that's
how
really
crazy
fast
some of these pitch jobs were, because the reality wave just sort of took off, and I was sort of on the crest of that with some of the shows I did with Mark Burnett back then. I did another one called...
Oh, yeah, small name, Mark Burnett.
Yeah. I did The Restaurant with him, another one called Combat Mission, so I did a few shows that he EP'd. And then I did American Idol as well before really anyone knew who Ryan Seacrest was, which is pretty astonishing to see his rise to stardom from there. There was another co-host back then, Brian Dunkelman, who people may not remember as well. It was based on Pop Idol, which was the UK version that we were sort of adapting for an American audience, and it's kind of interesting to see how much stayed and how much changed, and actually more stayed than you would imagine, even right down to the theme song, where they thought it was perhaps going to be nearly reinvented, but the core of it was so popular, even like the gold of it, and even the corny parts people seem to love, you know. And because in the original we were watching clips of guys, you know, being busted in the bathroom, singing in the shower, and their wife or mom said, "My son's got talent." And then they, "You want to be on Pop Idol?" So there was like the two sort of Dunkelmans and Seacrest that were the guys in Pop Idol, yeah, were like, show up like kind of like Candy Cameron over here, someone singing, and you know, kind of like you're going to Hollywood sort of thing, and they're thinking, you know, so it was a different that we were adapting on that first pilot episode that I worked on years ago. So it's come a long way, and it's still going strong. So I'm proud to have at least I did Chicago and Miami, two of the first cities that they did on the original. So that was quite a adventure with my reality roots, for sure.
Did you guys back then, for that show, specifically first season of Survivor, cut on a computer, or did you cut?
Yes, that was, I don't think you could do Survivor without Avid. My God, it was like, there were 20 plus cameras on almost every game. And in those days, we would sort of stack the tracks. And then it, as it evolved, we got into camera grouping more and more, which is sort of the norm for almost any action scene or music video, you know, that where you can just group multiple cameras so you can literally look at anything almost instantaneously, which is so that the best shot can kind of raise its hand and tell you what to use, you know, as the film speaks to you when you're looking at all that footage.
All right, my last nerdy question here. Where, back then, like, you know, it was like Real World and Simple Life and Survivor were sort of the big three first that I know of.
Yes.
Were the cameras time-locked to each other, meaning they shared the same exact time code to the millisecond?
Well, on the game, some of the cameras were so far apart that not always. You know, I think it's probably come a long way, because now they have drones out there. They have so many more cameras than even when I was working on it, you know, back in the early 2000s. So we had a lot of, you know, cameras like lipstick cams and cameras buried in like different places, yeah, that we would use. But you couldn't, like, if you were doing a rowing competition, it was pretty hard to sync a camera from the island that's a mile away with the people on the shore. And so we would look for abstract things like people clapping hands or, wow, banging on, yeah, the side of something to, like, so you'd spend the first few days editing, just sort of syncing up the cameras and trying to get everything lined up on your timeline. And then you would sort of dig through it and find the gold. And my approach was always find, you know, because you had to boil down generally a 20 or 30 minute game into 6 or 7 minutes for air. So you can imagine how much got left out. So I try to find the most interesting aspects of the game, and then sort of, you know, treat that as sort of like the Christmas tree to be decorated. Like, here's the core of it.
Yeah.
And then, like, how can I, you know, keep adding things like reactions or music or sound ups just to
heighten, kind of make the skeleton and then
the drama,
out the skeleton.
And then try to figure out a way to sort of zoom along to the next interesting thing so you could, quote, get the shoe leather out. You know, like, if people are rowing for 15 minutes, that's not terribly exciting. But if someone falls off the boat, all of a sudden you've got drama. Now they're not a very good swimmer, you've got more drama, you know. Or you're doing something where someone has to jump off a cliff into the water. Like, who do you focus on? Well, the people that are scared of heights and the people that don't swim very well. So you're building up the drama.
Yeah.
And then all the other people that are trying to cheer them on, you can do this. Yeah. So yeah, that was the beauty of Survivor. It's literally almost a perfect television show, because if things go right, you have drama in that direction. If things go wrong, you have drama. You know, it's that's what drama is. It's sort of irony and ecstasy and comedy, drama, and tragedy. You know, that's why they have the two faces on the drama.
That's it.
Michael, so I'm going to throw to you, because I have a question. How does, as a feature screenwriter, who I've read your work and I really like it. Well, you know this. I'm just... how do you see what he just said reflected in when you're writing? Because you're writing pure fiction, of course, which we've also worked in.
It's all drama, actually. There's no difference, as Mitch was saying. There's no difference. You have to elicit, first of all, imagination. If I tell you a story, you go, how does that work? And second, it's how do you keep interest? Okay, whether it's on television or movies or streaming, it's all really the same kind of thing. It's there's a technique to it, I suppose. With television, you have the cliffhanger, it gets you through the commercial, and then you pick it up, and then another one, and another one, and another one. But film, I don't think it's any different, frankly. It's all story, and how do you keep somebody watching? When I went to grad school at Boston University, I had a film professor, and as any of these film classes, it's an analysis on doing a film. So my I forgot what the movie was, but my analysis, the way I did it, was not simply this is what the film does and so on and so forth. I had a dialogue between two characters in the film doing analysis of the film they're in. And so I get the paper back, and I got a great grade. But he said something very important to me that is really important for writers, I think, which is that in his notes, which are always given with the grade, he said, here I am, it's Sunday night, 1 a.m. I've read 20 papers. Yours is the 21st. I want to go to sleep. And suddenly I read this, and I'm awake. So the question in screenwriting and storytelling is, you have to think of a reader, a coverage, a producer, whomever. It's 1 a.m. on a Sunday night. They've read 20 scripts. Yours is the 21st. How do you get them to wake up? How do you get them interested? And that's the trick, whether it be Survivor or The Godfather or pick whatever film you like. You've got to wake people up and go, wait a minute, I was about to fall asleep and I'm awake again. And that's the trick of it, whether it be anybody doing any of these things. Your father doing Legs Diamond. Who is this guy? I didn't know who Legs Diamond was, but here's this handsome guy, jet black hair, and he's a murderer. And I go, this is interesting. It's no more complicated or simple than that, because it's not. But that's the trick of it. And if you can, as I say, rook the script or make or break the whatever, then you got something. If you don't, well, you don't.
Yeah, he was certainly dynamic in that role, so I encourage the listeners if they watch one Ray Danton film, watch The Rise and Fall of Lex Diamond, because it's very...
The minute he walks on, you are riveted to him. Your mother as well. I mean, I like the creature, but when you saw Julie Adams, you went, who dat?
No, it was interesting. Almost every director she ever worked with saved a close-up for her entrance.
I would say.
And it's like time stood still when she walked into the room.
Well, as I was saying, it's Mitchell. I mean, there are a coterie of directors, and these are the directors who kept the game going. You know, we could talk about the Betchers of the world, Anthony Manns, who were known quantities. But then you had other directors, Universal International, had a slew of these people who they were the line directors.
Yeah, we could mention Raoul Walsh.
Raoul Walsh, who was, I think, a little bit better at that, because Walsh is not as well known as Jack Ford or Howard Hawks,
I think he directed The Lawless Breed that Mom was in. I think I'm correct. Let me just look
it
up.
I'll double check. He did a Cagney film.
But he's kind of a legendary character as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The Roaring Twenties was his. He was a uncommon. He did High Sierra with Bogart. Bogart's breakout film.
Did he do High Sierra? Wow.
With Ida Lupino, and he was his first Bogart's first film where he was a sympathetic character.
And then we can also talk about Tickle Me, which was
White
Elvis
Heat
film.
Was the Cagney film he did.
He did White Heat. Oh my God!
Great, great, great film. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Tickle Me is a good one to mention because that was her experience with Elvis.
Yeah.
I think that's a good story.
Oh, cool.
That was always a fan favorite. Yes, it was a film called Tickle Me, and she used to say, if you'll pardon the expression. And she thought he was a Southern gentleman, and she was from the South. She was grew up in Arkansas, so she knew a Southern gentleman when she saw one. And she adored working with him. She said he was a phenomenon. He was able to do the musical numbers in one take. And one story that he shared with her from his time in the service was he said, the whole time I was there, I just wanted to be one of the guys. And they were between takes, and she was a few years older than Elvis. And she said, "You're Elvis Presley. You're never just going to be one of the guys." And she tried to tell him. But she thought it was so endearing that someone who was one of the most famous people on earth just wanted to be one of the guys. Yeah. And that said so much about maybe why he was so famous and so adored, is that he never really, you know, sort of got caught up in it. Yeah. It was more like that was what he got, that's what he became, and not necessarily what he always aspired to.
He wanted to be an actor, actually.
Yes, and she said he was a good actor. She said he was, you know, because of the films weren't always, you know, the best films that he was in, that he was underrated. But, Tickle Me, I believe, was for Allied Artists, and it helped, it made a lot of money and helped save the studio.
Yeah.
So it was a big hit, and she played the owner of a dude ranch. And it's quite a story. Her character was Vera Radford, and he comes into her office, and she sort of plays a cougar, as you would call them today. Yeah. And she's sort of coming on to him romantically, and he says, "Ma'am, I thought this job was strictly business." And she says, "Oh, I mean business." And she kisses him. And if you watch one scene in the film, and there's even a clip of that moment in the trailer, if you even get a few minutes to watch it on IMDb, it is actually, it's cinematic magic, the two of them together in that moment. And I had the good fortune of going to a lot of conventions over the years, and that picture of Mom and Elvis was one of the fan favorites.
You had mentioned how he wanted to be one of the guys, but I mean, he was an international celebrity. For your parents, they both wanted to be actors and became actors. What was that like for them, balancing personal life with success? You know, well, I know LA was different when they were acting as well. It wasn't quite so, you know, there were no smartphones. There was not a lot of paparazzi. The studios controlled a lot of publicity. What was that like for them? How did they balance that? What did they want from their publicity?
It was interesting because my father, you know, he was, by the time I was aware of his career, he was already getting into directing, and he had that personality that he was kind of done with people telling him where to stand, what his marks were, and, you know, and he had a very simple philosophy about acting, which was like, be on time and know your lines, you know, it's like, and start with the basics, you know, and, but when he directed, he was very well respected because he had been an actor. So regardless of what the crew thought of him, the actors always loved him. And if you had the actors in your camp when you were a guest director, that was half the battle, you know. And my mother was literally very down to earth. You know, she was the woman that, you know, drove the family station wagon to the studio.
Yeah.
So I think that's why she was so adored, you know, just because throughout her life, she just related to people of all walks of life, and she had grown up in the Depression. So I would literally, if you drove off a freeway, you know, and you saw someone like asking for a dollar, she'd be like, "Look at that poor nice man, you know, he needs money, we have to stop," you know, and it was like, not everybody's like that, you know. You know, near the end of her life, when I was going through some of her affairs, I mean, she'd given to like almost every charity, you know, they were like, there's letters from, you know, WildCare or World Wildlife Foundation or Habitat for Humanity. And she literally cared about other people. And I think that was part of her allure when she was on a publicity tour, where I know her and Rock Hudson were on a publicity tour for Bend of the River. And they would travel. I think it was a lot more traveling back then because you couldn't, you know, you weren't just everywhere at once in sort of the internet today or in the early stages of television. You literally went to the premiere, you know, and I think people still do that, but to those extents that you were literally traveling a lot more. And she went to the Oscars, for example, you know, in the early 50s. I think it was the year of the African Queen that Bogart won.
51.
And she was, I believe it had something to do with Bend of the River and Arthur Kennedy. And she was perhaps going to accept for one of his roles. And she was sort of relieved when Bogey won. She could relax and have a nice evening after that. But it was, but they would send her off quite often. You know, the publicity department and the hair department would make them up so that they were a big part of their mystique and their, you know, allure to the audiences, so that they always had a certain look and things about them. And they were, a very glamorous couple when they were first married, so there was a lot of to-do about where they were, what they were doing together. When my older brother was born, that was a big deal. You know, he was born in the 50s, so it was like a, you know, that was during the time of their contract years. So that was like a, you know, made the, you know,
the studio used it as part of their
public image, whatever the tabloids or the papers, and they were married in 1955, and that was a big deal. And so, yeah, by the time I was born in the 60s, it was like sort of past the studio era, and my father was getting into directing and things like that. So a lot of the things I heard about the great bridge parties with Rock Hudson, you know, were almost hearsay.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of, you know, folks like that that did visit, and that was a big part of it. You know, my father, like as I mentioned, he was probably more aloof towards it because he was working towards using his acting skills to segue into directing, which he successfully did, which is, as I look back on it, it's remarkable. He started out doing films overseas and then got into, you know, low-budget horror and then into mainstream television to the point of, you know, winning awards. And he worked on some of the HBO early shows, one called Vietnam War Story, a home episode when they back when they had Cable Ace Awards. He won one of those for a story about vets coming home and dealing with their disabilities after the war.
Yeah.
So he was just a wonderful director, and they actually worked together on Quincy. My mom did multiple episodes that he directed.
Oh.
She was a character in Psychic Killer as well, the film I mentioned that he directed. So she played a psychiatrist in that. So even though they weren't married anymore, they had mutual respect for.
That's great.
She would always say he is a wonderful director, and she admired his work as a director, even though they were not married anymore. Mm-hmm. And he still, you know, hired her to act in his shows. So they were very simpatico, as my mother used to say, post divorce.
Great.
Yeah, and that's not always the case, as we know. So it was nice to. The one episode I wanted to mention was The Miracle at Camafeo, 1972, Night Gallery, one of the last roles or episodes that they worked in together. And she played Gay Melkor, and then my father was another character in that. He was trying to scam the system, if it was like an insurance scam. So he was pretending to be disabled, you know, and then he's going to be cured in this shrine in Mexico. But as most people learn in a Rod Serling episode, it doesn't always work out when you try and cheat the universe in the end. So I do recommend, if you want to see my parents acting together, The Miracle at Camafeo in a memorable episode of Night Gallery from 1972 is a good example of both of their work together as actors.
For you, growing up here, having parents that were glamorous, that were famous, just you specifically, and you could even contrast yourself with your brother or with your friends. What was that like? Like, you went to school here, or went to high school here. What was, could you just, you know, having lived it, could you give us sort of your take on what it was like?
Yeah, I went to Oakwood when I was young, so there were a lot of people in the business. Robert Blake's kids were there, and we all know what happened with Robert Blake post those years. But there were a lot of actor kids at that time. Bob Rafelson's kids were there, who was the famous director, who was maybe not as well known today, but Five Easy Pieces was a Oscar contender back in the
day. A very good director.
Yeah, very good director.
The Monkees.
Yes. So there were. I got to cross paths with some people like that, and then when my parents split up when I was in about the sixth grade, you know, money was tight. You know, my mom had started out as a bathing beauty. It's hard to make that transition to being the mom character or the 40-year-old businesswoman or whatever you were, you know, playing from like all the roles you played in your 20s and 30s. So my father was transitioning to directing, doing low-budget horror. So, you know, money was tight. And the creature phenomenon wasn't quite what it is today. It kind of had a lull. Like, people knew what it was, but then it sort of like got re-energized with the Jaws phenomenon when, like, people saw some of the shots, and there's some good comparisons between those two films in terms of some of the shots that are in the film, the music, the creature, and Bruce the Shark both have their own theme. Not every monster had their own theme. The creatures the first monster that had his own theme, the three horns, bop, 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 and then Jaws is da-dum, da-dum. So right, there's right. so many similarities between the underwater and the swimming scenes that it sort of caught a new wave, no pun intended, that sort of took it into new heights as, and then as the whole convention circuit built up, then, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, my mom started doing the convention circuit, and we got to see kind of what, how many fans this film actually had when you went to towns outside of Los Angeles. But when I was in high school, my father was directing TV, so some people knew some of the shows like Quincy that he was working on and things like that, and some of the parents recognized him, you know, from some of his movies. And my mom was also in Murder, She Wrote right around that time, where she did 10 episodes. So a lot of the, it was the number one show on CBS for a number of years, and she did 10 episodes as Eve Simpson, the realtor of Cabot Cove. And her famous line about that was, Eve liked money and she liked men. And then all the moms that I met was like, that's not a bad combination. And so she was hilarious in that role. And she really learned to hone her comedy craft, because as you were mentioning, as you leave LA, celebrity seems to grow bigger because people don't see celebrities every day. So she did a lot of dinner theater, which was a big thing in the 70s.
Yeah.
And where she would be guest starring on, you know, roles on television. She would be the lead in a, you know, in El Paso or St. Louis or other towns outside of LA. And I got to see some of that, the fame in terms of like how much more famous she was, because she could write those 20 movies that she was in, and she could open a play with a bunch of people that were either from the community theaters nearby or actors that lived in the area, and they would cast one sort of celebrity to open the show. And then the other people I met were all wonderful actors, but so that was kind of a, and I got to do one called Finishing Touches with her, which was a Jean Kerr play.
Okay.
And I played Huey, like her son, and it was like a comedy. But the nice thing about live comedy is you know if a joke works or not right away. There's no fudging it with the editing by trimming up some frames or changing out takes. You got one chance at that line. And I remember I got, like, I had one of the opening lines in the play, and I got a big laugh, and all of a sudden you feel, as my mom said, you get this flush of power when the audience reacts to something you do, and that's what she called the acting bug that bit her as a young girl and carried her through her whole life. She just loved acting, and it was nice that, you know, they were able to have kind of a new chapter when I was in high school and junior high, whether she was on the stage or my father was directing television, and then she got to land some recurring roles on some big shows at that time. Another big one around that era was Capital, which was a soap opera that was on in the 80s about Washington, D.C., and she played a character called Paula Denning, who had agoraphobia. So she loved that character. She was pretending to be locked. Her alibi was that she couldn't go outside, but then she would sneak out and be committing all kinds of capers. And she had the alibi that she was afraid of going outside. So there was like she was, and that was one thing I really admired about her career. She played some recurring roles like Paula Denning and Eve Simpson, but many of her roles were one-offs. And she literally, some actors you see, and it's like, they're a movie star, and they're the same person in every role. And you're like, oh, I know who this is. I don't need any backstory. I've seen 20 of their movies. I know this character. But literally, she was a chameleon. Like, she would show up, and whether it was Bonanza, The Big Valley, The Rifleman, she had an episode called Nora on The Rifleman that really kind of changed her good girl image from, like, most of the roles she played at Universal Studios, like Creature from the Black Lagoon. She was kind of the girl next door. First woman to play a scientist on film, you know. And then when she played Nora, she was kind of like this mysterious woman from the past, you know. She did Bonanza, an episode of that, and also The Big Valley. That was another good one with Barbara Stanwyck. She did a fight scene with her in the basement in the fire. So she played some more duplicitous characters, as she liked to call them in the Westerns. And then, as I mentioned, she played a very nice character, Mary Simpson, the county nurse, on Andy Griffith around the same time. So she was really a chameleon, and that's what I, you know, you imagine waking up and being someone literally different sometimes multiple times in a week. Some of those days, for instance, on McHugh, she had one scene. She played John Wayne's ex-wife, And so many people remember that role. Yeah. And she's literally in one scene, and she kind of humanizes him because she kind of tells him what's what, because she's not, and she's in a new relationship. Here's her ex-husband, and she has this one scene that's very memorable in the film. Yeah. And I think, and she was very different in all these different parts she played, you know, that she won a Golden Boot Award. You know, she's in the Arkansas Entertainers Hall of Fame. She won a Cinecon Career Achievement Award. So all these things, as I was sort of spending time with her, you know, later in her life, kind of came to fruition from all the work she'd done over the years. You know, she'd won a Soap Opera Digest Award. She won a Dramalog Award for Long Day's Journey into Night, which is a play that few people saw, but was well remembered by so many. Yeah. What if there was someone out there?
Did she play Mary Tyrone in that?
Yes, she played Mary Tyrone, the matriarch of the Tyrone family, which is...
That's a great role.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah, she... So she said she wasn't really a crier, but her childhood was troubled in the Depression. You know, her parents were alcoholics, and she had a tough childhood, and she, long before she was Miss Little Rock, she had some tough times, you know, just reading books and dreaming of another life.
You've got a book, I believe, here, right?
Yes.
Talk about that a little.
My assistant, Betsy Comstock, who's very talented, and we were working on a scene together, and she said, "You're good at explaining this. You should write a book." So I went on that, and I ended up with 378 pages, lo and behold, after a few years of meeting some of the best in the business that have... the great Michael Kahn wrote the introduction for the book, and I was able to talk with him, and... so many other, like Norman Buckley, who's now a director, who was an Eddie Award-winning editor. It's titled Cutting It in Hollywood, Top Film Editors Share Their Journeys. It's on Amazon. It's also on my website, cuttingitinhollywood.com. And then my mom's book, which we've sold nearly 3,000 copies of. We have a few left on her website, julieadams.biz.
Mitch, thank you so much for joining us here at Coffee Fix.
Well, it's been a pleasure joining you on Recapturing Hollywood and sharing some stories from the good old days and some stories from the not-so-distant past and present as well. So thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
Thank you to Vincent Apodo, who composed and conducted the score that you hear at the beginning and end of our segments. And you can find other conversations like this at recapturinghollywood.com. Hope to see you around again soon.